This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It was the last week of January, and this week we got news about two new COVID vaccines. Vaccines from Johnson & Johnson and Novavax have some results from phase 3 clinical trials showing the vaccines are effective. But the numbers are not as good as the numbers we previously saw for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, which use a different technology. Novavax and Johnson & Johnson also show some signs of being less effective against some of the mutated variants of the virus that causes COVID-19, though that data is also preliminary and mixed. The good news from these announcements is the vaccines look to be highly effective at preventing hospitalization and death, even if they don't stop all mild or moderate cases of COVID-19. But still, the variants are complicating the picture for persistently beating this epidemic. Vaccine manufacturers are already working on modifications and booster shots that we might be getting some months after our initial vaccines. But the most important thing right now to get the virus to stop changing so fast is to reduce the number of cases, because more infections means more opportunities for the virus to mutate. And here in the U.S., the vaccination campaign is accelerating, with states getting somewhat increased weekly deliveries and the expectation that some of these new vaccines, especially Johnson & Johnson, could be approved for emergency use within weeks. To discuss all of that, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. On the right, Lonhee Chen is the David and Diane Steffi Fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's the Director of Domestic Policy Studies at Stanford. Hello, Lonhee.
Good to be with you, Josh.
And on the left, David Dayan is the Executive Editor of the American Prospect. Hi, David.
Hi, how you doing?
So, David, President Biden has taken a number of executive actions that are intended to speed up the pace of this vaccination campaign, including invoking the Defense Production Act to speed the production of certain materials that are necessary for vaccination. Donald Trump also made some use of this act during his presidency. Do you have a sense of the extent to which Biden's approach and the announcements that we've seen over the last week plus, are these a big change in strategy, or is this a continuation with some adjustments of the strategy under the last administration?
Well, I think it's an acceleration of the strategy. I think the important thing is the use of the federal response in terms of distribution. So the big thing, I think, on that front that they announced this week is that not only would they increase the allocation to the states by 16%, but they committed to that over the next 3 weeks. And the biggest problem with the rollout has been that states had no idea what they were getting or when they were getting it. And so by setting a clear schedule, states can actually come up with an actual timeline where they can say to their residents, yeah, we know we're going to have this much and we can give you an appointment over the next 3 weeks, because we know that that particular allocation is going to be there. So that, I think, was one of the biggest things that they did this week. As far as the Defense Production Act, I think that, yes, the Trump administration did use some of this. They're going a bit further. They're even apparently exploring the retooling of factories to allow vaccines that are already approved to be manufactured by other drug manufacturers. That I think would be quite important and should have been done, frankly, months ago. But all of this is in service to ensuring that there's not a supply snag down the road. And of course, the Johnson & Johnson and Novavax announcements make that a little bit of an easier lift, because you're going to have more supply if those indeed get approved for emergency use. But I think that we're going to need more vaccine next year and down the road. And we're going to need it all across the world, and everywhere in the world getting more vaccine helps the United States on both a health and economic level. So we really should be using the DPA to compel manufacturing of these additional vaccines. If Novartis or Merck is out of the game of making a vaccine now, they should be making the Pfizer vaccine. They should be making the Moderna vaccine. They should be making the Johnson & Johnson vaccine.
Lanhi, what do you make of that? We have had this announcement in Europe that Sanofi, the French pharmaceutical company whose own vaccine development has not gone so great, that they're going to make 100 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine for the European market. Is that what David's identifying there? Is that something the U.S. government should be focusing on, trying to get more companies making the vaccines that we know work? And beyond that, what do you make of the first week and a half of the Biden administration taking these steps to speed the vaccine rollout? And I think to something we discussed last week, we were saying the goals don't look ambitious enough. They've started changing their rhetoric somewhat, saying a million doses a day is a floor. We're already up to 1.7 million doses one day this week. So it seems like they're shifting their rhetorical commitments at least a little bit to the idea that they need to go faster.
Yeah, I think, Josh, it's a shift in tone, to be sure. The federal government is clearly taking a more assertive role. During the last administration, the federal government saw itself more as a facilitator. And I think you are seeing that change in mindset, which clearly at some level makes a difference. I think some of this can be overblown. I mean, the Defense Production Act's a good example of that. Most of the companies that would be targets of the DPA have already been in close contact with the Biden administration. And some of the things that the DPA would be used for are things like these low dead space syringes you've heard about, which essentially are syringes that allow for 6 doses of the Pfizer vaccine to be extracted per vial rather than 5. Becton Dickinson and Company is the company that manufactures these syringes in the U.S. And, you know, that's something we really didn't realize we needed until the vaccine rollout was underway. And so some of this is again, the federal government engaged in conversations and discussions with these companies rather than trying to beat them over the head with it. At some point, yeah, I do think it'll be a question of whether we try to get those pharmaceutical companies that are not producing a vaccine themselves to assist in production. You know, it's not as simple as taking a factory and just saying, okay, we're going to flip a switch and tomorrow we're going to make the Moderna vaccine. It is quite complex. Each of these formulations, in the case of the Pfizer one, is quite delicate. In particular, there are some serious requirements on storage. There are some serious requirements on sterilization once for example, the actual vaccine has been placed into the vial. So there's a lot of sort of process things that have to get worked out. But I'd agree, the goal overall does need to be, how do we get as much supply online as quickly as possible? And that is something, to the point about what the Biden administration has done, offering more transparency to states around what supply is coming their way, when they can expect it. And therefore, it's up to states to put in place a plan that gets the vaccine supply that they are getting into people's arms, and hopefully that transparency will help. In terms of the first week and a half or whatever of the Biden administration, I think that the overall thematic there is they are endeavoring to show that they are acting to overturn and push back on a lot of what the Trump administration did via executive action. And the use of executive action in this way, I'd argue, far more aggressively in the first 10 days of the Biden presidency than any presidency in American history, is really to demonstrate that action. There's a political marker they're setting down. The actual substance of some of these EOs, you know, is pretty limited. At the end of the day, executive action has to hinge on an existing statutory provision. So if it's an executive order, for example, you've got to state what statutory provision you're relying on to engage in that action. You know, in some cases, it's more language than it is anything else. But what they're clearly trying to do is to show that they are doing something different. And to me, that ends up being much more about the politics and about the substance of it. And we can get into some of the EOs and some of the various executive actions that the Biden administration has taken. But overall, what they're trying to do is to demonstrate that they're doing something. And that is probably more politically valuable than anything else.
David, what's your assessment of that? I mean, at the American Prospect, you had been pushing what you call the day one agenda. I think it's fair to say that you were looking for Joe Biden to have the most aggressive rollout ever in terms of use of executive action right at the beginning of his administration. Has he actually delivered on that, or is Lanhi right to say that a lot of this is basically for show?
So I want to briefly respond to what Lanhi said about, it taking a long time and it not being an overnight process to retool these factories. I will get to the other question. you know, we know how long actually it takes to retool because Pfizer had to do it. They completely had to change over what they were doing at their stateside factory to, you know, accommodate an mRNA vaccine. And it took several months. Well, we know we're going to need more vaccine in 2022. There is no time like the present to begin that process. And so I really do think that some more aggressiveness can be taken here. And the Biden team has said that they're actively exploring this. So I would like to move from active exploration to cementing it. But I do think that there's a need here. And we know that it doesn't take a year because there wasn't a coronavirus vaccine a year ago. So we know that there's a limited time frame where you could, you know, theoretically do this changeover, and we should do it. So as far as executive action, yes, we have called for in the day one agenda significant actions, all based on statutory authority. We are putting out next week a tracker of the actions that we called for and what Biden has actually done. And I can preview that by saying of the 77 actions that we called for in a variety of articles over the course of the last year and a half, Biden has taken action either in part or in whole on 11 of them. So we think that there's plenty more room to run here. It is true that some of these are a little bit less than meets the eye. One of them that I like to look at is Biden made an order to cancel Justice Department contracts with private prisons, which, you know, is a nice signal saying that we don't want to privatize the incarceration system. But Justice Department contracts aren't really where the private prison industry is as located and as immersed. It's really with immigration detention. About 8% of federal prisoners are in privatized beds. About 72% of immigrant detainees are in privatized beds. So by not extending that order to cancel DHS contracts with the private prison industry, he's not really affecting their business model in any real way. And he's not living up to the sort of rhetoric of no, you know, there shouldn't be for-profit prisons, there shouldn't be for-profit detention in America. So that's a good example of how, you know, these things can look symbolically significant, but maybe not under the surface truly significant. I think there's more to be done. But I will say that I have been kind of surprised and shocked at some of the pushback to the notion of taking executive action. This is the textbook definition of what a president is tasked with doing in the Constitution, to take care that the laws are faithfully executed. The president is an implementer. The president is not a lawmaker. Congress passes the laws. The president implements the laws. And Biden is implementing them in the way that he believes is you know, valid and authorized under these various statutes. And the fact that this is seen as somehow cheating or not playing fair or I don't know what is really baffling to me.
Lonnie, I know you've been especially following some of the executive orders that relate to healthcare and health insurance. Do they meet that standard that David laid out there, that they're just exercising the statutory power that the president has?
Yeah, I think that's an oversimplistic view of this. I mean, quite frankly, to simply say that an administration that President Biden, and by the way, I made the same arguments about President Trump's executive actions too. The notion that you simply refer loosely to a statute and say, oh, we're just implementing it. We're just, you know, shaping implementation so that it fits with our administration's priorities is bogus. This is really about using that as a cover to advance really significant policy change in some cases. And to advance it in a way that I think is extra legal, that is extra constitutional, and should worry anybody that cares about the constitutional design of our system. Again, I think that's why a lot of these executive actions, frankly, a lot of the executive actions that Trump took, do get challenged in court, because they precisely because it's not just about taking a law and interpreting it and trying to advance it in a particular way. It's much more pernicious than that. And I think that's the danger. In terms of the specific executive order on healthcare, I think it's interesting because there are things there that are much more significant than seen at first blush. And there are things that are much less significant than they would appear. For example, one of the things that they've done in the executive order on healthcare is to create a second, what's known as open enrollment period coming up here on February 15th, beginning February 15th for the month, that basically allows people to buy coverage via the ACA marketplaces, healthcare.gov, state marketplaces. And if they qualify for subsidies under the ACA, which the ACA subsidizes people's coverage if they make up to 400% of federal poverty, about $100,000 a year for a family of four, if they are able to afford that coverage, they can buy it. The challenge, of course, is that there's not necessarily a whole lot more to help people afford that coverage. The idea was, well, if we open it up, people might come in and buy coverage. This is the same problem that's plagued these marketplaces since day one, which is that, yes, you're providing a subsidy. Yes, in some cases, it is sufficient. But frankly, in many cases, it isn't to ensure affordability because these plans are still too expensive and costs are still too high. So it's a nice thing to say, yeah, if people want coverage, they can come in. On the margins, they'll probably bring some people in, but it's not meaningful at all in terms of the broader problem we have, which is why healthcare costs so much, why premiums are so high, why they get driven ever higher year after year. We still haven't addressed any of that. This is really a Band-Aid over a gaping wound. So, you know, there is that. And then there are other areas where it doesn't appear as though they're doing very much, but actually are doing a lot. So one of the things they've done in this executive order is to say, look, if the Trump administration gave states some flexibility to, for example, expand coverage in the way that they saw fit, we're going to go back and potentially revisit and revoke that. And this is something I've always argued for, which is that I think there can be a bipartisan way forward here where the federal government sets guardrails and the states are allowed essentially to innovate within those guardrails. And what this executive order basically does is to say, no, that innovation can't happen anymore unless it's entirely consistent with what we want. And I just don't think that's a great way forward when clearly there are political disagreements over healthcare, and we have to figure out a way to bridge that divide. So there are some elements of this executive order, as I said, that are more than meets the eye, and there are others that really, I think, are a lot less significant than the administration has made them out to be. But for sure, the use of executive action in this way should raise concerns amongst those who want to understand what the proper separation of powers is between the executive and the legislative branches in our government.
David, the concerns that Lanhi raises there about the exchanges mirror some concerns that I often hear from people on the left, which is basically that these plans that are intended to expand coverage and have expanded coverage to a significant extent, that it's complicated to sign up for, and that a lot of people just don't find it to be a good enough value to pay for it, even when it's subsidized. It's an even worse problem for people who don't qualify for subsidies. So I guess, you know, does the Biden administration have a satisfactory way of addressing it? I know Lanhi doesn't think that another open enrollment period is likely to do very much. What would do very much?
Well, I'm happy that Lanhi is seeing that the simplicity of perhaps a single payer system would be preferable to this complicated Rube Goldberg program of subsidies and mandates and things like that. First of all, let me say that what Lanhi's talking about there is showing how the Biden team actually isn't overstepping the authority granted to them by Congress. They're not adding to the subsidies. They can't do that. They would need legislative action to increase the subsidies and make the coverage on the exchange affordable. They're adding an open enrollment period so that people they can give more time. I mean, I think the real issue here is that the navigators and the encouragement to get people to enroll hasn't been there in the Trump era. And so this period would allow for much more outreach. And there's actually about $1 billion that was never used by the Trump administration for the express purpose of outreach, to find hard to reach people and try to get them covered if they can be covered. I would say that, you know, as far as the question of whether this is overstepping authority, just more generally, these executive orders, you know, the vast majority of Trump executive orders were challenged over administrative procedure. In other words, the fact that they didn't undo or repeal or change various regulations in the proper way with a notice and comment period and proper time to respond. It wasn't necessarily that they were overstepping their constitutional authority in every case. It's that they weren't following the law in the way that they could exercise that authority. You know, as far as I'm concerned, all these things are statutory. Congress granted this authority to the president to implement these laws. And if Congress doesn't like it, they can repeal that authority at any time. And, you know, I just feel like these laws are available and we need to have tangible progress on a host of issues. And this could be a way, in fact, to unlock the terrible gridlock that we have in our Congress if the president exercises this authority and Congress says, okay, well, now we have to act to take that back. So I think that there are certainly more that can be done using executive authority, which is a perfectly legitimate way to make progress for the American people.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Lonnie Chen of the Hoover Institution and David Dayan of the American Prospect to talk about one of the big issues where Joe Biden is looking to use his executive power: immigration. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm Josh Barrow. On the right is Lonnie Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is David Dayan, executive editor at the American Prospect. Shortly after the election, then-President-elect Joe Biden announced four priority areas that he would focus on as he started his term: beating COVID, restarting the economy, racial justice, and climate change. Pointedly missing from this list was immigration. But as he was taking office, Biden announced a very ambitious legislative proposal on immigration that would regularize some 11 million unauthorized immigrants currently living in the United States, granting them an 8-year path to citizenship. The path would be faster for Dreamers who came here as young people and for those with temporary protected status. Immigration levels would be increased going forward, and there would be enhanced efforts to improve conditions in Central America in an effort to take pressure off the flows of migrants trying to enter the U.S. from there via Mexico. What's not included in this proposal is some of the intense fortification of the border with Mexico that was in some prior bipartisan efforts on immigration, such as in 2013. This is a big plan, and if it was enacted, it would meet the demands of a lot of immigration activists, but it's not at all clear that there's the level of interest in Congress to get something like this passed. In the meantime, Biden is taking executive actions on immigration, and his team is asking for patience about changes in the situation at the southern border, where the Trump administration required migrants who are seeking asylum in the U.S. to remain in Mexico for extended periods, often in very poor conditions. To talk about what Joe Biden is doing and will do to change how immigration works, Priscilla Alvarez joins us now. She's an immigration reporter at CNN. Hello, Priscilla.
Hi, thanks for having me.
To set the table to talk about what Joe Biden is doing and intends to do, can you first lay out how U.S. immigration policy changed under President Trump? Because there was no major immigration legislation during his presidency, but he did quite a bit through his executive power to change and restrict how people can come to the U.S.
He did, and he did so through hundreds of executive actions. In fact, one of the ways that the Trump administration used to really overhaul the immigration system was through regulation. So his administration put out several regs, many of which were challenged in federal courts, that essentially changed the way we think about asylum. So, for example, putting up more barriers to be granted asylum here in the United States, having to meet certain standards. Another rule that was talked about quite a bit was public charge. And that sort of barred low-income immigrants from coming into the United States, the idea being that they not be a charge on the United States. So these changes happened consecutively and happened very quickly. And over time, they amounted to this change in the immigration system that effectively curtailed legal and illegal immigration to the United States. And that is where the Biden administration is coming in, and they have a lot on their plate to change that, reverse that. And it's something that officials have actually recognized even days coming into office, that this was going to take time. And while Biden will chip away with some of that through executive authority, which he did only hours into his presidency, it's going to take several months.
Right. I mean, because this process took Donald Trump a long time, right? We've already seen one court case where the Biden administration has lost in the first round in the Northern District of Texas, saying that Biden could not impose a 100-day moratorium on deportations. The reasoning in the decision actually looked a lot like the reasoning we saw in a lot of the decisions about Trump administration actions, saying that it looked like the Biden administration had not followed the Administrative Procedures Act. So basically, because of these rules about how you can do these actions, should we assume that it's going to take Joe Biden a lot of time to undo whatever it is that Trump did in terms of changing immigration policy?
Yes, and I think you raise a really important point, which is that just as Trump faced challenges in court, the Biden administration can anticipate the same. And that it's going to happen in some cases with judges who were appointed by Trump. And that's exactly what we saw happen with the deportation pause. So the Biden administration came in, they put a pause on deportations for 100 days. And only days into that, a federal judge in Texas shot it down and blocked it for 14 days. And in fact, there's a hearing again on the matter to decide next steps. But so there's two things happening. There's the Biden administration wanting to come in and undo the policies and recognizing that just logistically, that's going to take time. But they also are conceding and realizing that there will be legal challenges that happen along the way, and they will have to contend with those as they happen.
David, what should a strategy look like on that for the Biden administration? Obviously, they have to work their way through some of these regulatory channels. There's also a law called the Congressional Review Act, which some Trump administration policies that were issued very late in the administration, not the public charge rule, which was issued too long ago. But some of those, Congress can basically say, we don't like this regulation, we're going to reverse it. That gets you around the courts. What should the Biden administration be doing in terms of an approach to as quickly as they can impose the policies that they're looking to through the executive powers that they have?
I think they're trying to work it out. I know that there were supposed to be some additional actions on Friday on immigration, and they delayed them. The tricky thing with the Congressional Review Act is there's a part of it that says that not only is that that particular regulation repealed, but you cannot do anything substantially similar regarding that regulation without congressional assent. So you kind of box yourself in a little bit, and I think they're trying to work through that right now. We certainly have an issue on the border, and have for some time, where there have been masses of asylum seekers and other potential undocumented people, massing at the border at different towns, trying to figure out if they can get into the country. It's a really humanitarian crisis, especially during a pandemic, in addition to being just, a policy and legal problem. So, I know that this is going to take time, and I know that this is going to be, a slow and evolving process. But the fact that there is this urgency at the border right now, it argues for trying to move this thing along as quickly as possible.
Lonnie, to the extent that these executive actions are aimed at reversing executive actions from the Trump administration, do you find those legally or constitutionally suspect in the way that you might find some other executive actions? I mean, if this was the policy and practice in the Obama administration, Trump used his powers to change it, and Biden's changing it back, it seems like if it was permissible then, it should be permissible now.
Yeah, I think there's a couple points to make here. First of all, if all Biden is doing is overturning what Trump did, then the question we have to return to is, was the original action undertaken in many cases during the Obama administration, was that legal or not? And for example, I think a lot of people have debated the way essentially in which the DACA program was created via informal agency guidance issued by the Department of Homeland Security back many years ago. You know, the question is essentially, can you take that and bend it one way or the other based on what your political preferences are? And I think, you know, that ends up being a very challenging thing, not the least of which for people who are implicated in that policy. And that's why immigration reform is one of these areas that fundamentally I do think needs to happen through the legislative process. It needs to happen through the legislative process, first of all, because it's incredibly complex. And chances are that if you try to change elements of it, change elements of admission status to the United States via executive action, you're going to end up in court and throwing people's lives into disarray. You have to do this via the legislative process to create certainty and to ensure that those who are affected by the policy aren't jerked around from one administration to another, which is essentially what we have now, which is why I do applaud the effort. I think it's an important effort to try and get immigration reform through the Congress, to do it in a way that ensures it's lasting and durable. And that's a process at the end of the day that I think is the right way to do this. So you're not going back and forth on a subject area that does create a lot of human turmoil. And I think that's the challenge with how Obama did it originally, then Trump went through the executive action process to essentially say, we're not going to do it that way. And now Biden is reverting back to what I think is the flawed original guidance from the Obama administration.
Priscilla, I want to ask you about that legislative outlook. But first, I want to ask about what David mentioned about the humanitarian situation on the U.S.-Mexico border. The Biden administration has signaled that it intends to make changes there, but maybe not very quickly. And back in 2014, the migrant crisis that the Obama administration faced was a significant problem, and not just a political problem, but a situation where they were not finding good or easy answers about how to address that. So is there a sense of how quickly things will change at the border and what they will be doing to improve conditions there without causing an unsustainable flow of migrants to the border?
That is the question. It is one of the most challenging things that is facing the Biden administration when it comes to immigration, because frankly, it's a much more difficult situation that we're seeing on the border, because there are two things happening. We have several thousand migrants who are at the southern border who are waiting for their immigration court date in the U.S. This was under the Trump era policy, formerly known as the Migrant Protection Protocols. And so they have been coming into the U.S. for their court date and then back to to Mexico, where they have to remain until their case has concluded. That had delays, of course, because of the pandemic when the immigration courts had to close. But the point being that we have several thousand. Last I checked, there were more than 22,000 pending cases along the border courts from this policy. So you have that. And then you could also have continued flows to the southern border, given the deteriorating conditions in Central America. Not only were they reeling from the pandemic, but they've also were hit by two hurricanes, which destroyed regions. And so there's several push factors kind of happening there too. And then of course is the COVID overlay. So this is all incredibly complicated, because the Biden administration has said that they want to end the so-called Remain in Mexico policy. But how do you do that with the COVID overlay on top of that? Do you isolate vulnerable people and try to have them come into the U.S. and continue their court cases while here in the U.S.? How do you deal with processing? Do you test migrants? These are all questions that they are having to think through. And they're certainly a priority, because they do have to address this population of people. And I think this all dovetails into the legislation as well. If you want to pass immigration reform, it's incredibly complicated, as we've all seen over the years. And it's a hard thing to balance if you're also dealing with a crisis on the border. So you're sort of looking at two things at once, simultaneously trying to manage the situation at the border while also pushing through reform, which is ultimately what is going to make the most permanent change.
What are the legislative prospects for that? Because my cynical take on it, maybe it was too cynical when this plan was announced, was that this doesn't look like something that can get through Congress, but that the Biden administration knows and expects that the necessarily slow change of pace through the executive actions that they will take on immigration may be disappointing to certain people in Democratic Party coalition. And so they want to come out with this big, ambitious proposal, whether or not it actually can pass Congress in anything resembling this form. Do you have a sense? Are they really serious about trying to get this through Congress? And what's the strategy for doing that?
The way that the top White House officials are talking about this is that the bottom line is that some reform needs to happen, because as much as you can change policies through executive authority, again, that's not going to have permanent change. And I think DACA, for example, is a great example of that. It happened under Obama, the Obama administration. They were already in limbo, thrown more into limbo under the Trump administration when it volleyed through the courts. And now, you know, DREAM Act, it's been more than a decade, if not two. So the question is, you know, can we provide permanent change for them, a path to citizenship on top of some other immigrants in the country, those under temporary protected status and essential workers and so on? But I think you're right. We've seen this happen before. We've seen reform attempts before. We have to see the details of the legislation. Remember, we've seen the summary, but we haven't seen the fine text. And so that is going to be important in deciding the way forward. But I think something that I've gathered in talking to folks is that I think there's a recognition that it can be broken up into pieces. So maybe it's not the full package, but it's parts of it. And moving through that piecemeal could be a way forward.
Lonnie, what do you make of that? Because I look at this very narrow Democratic majority in Congress and a Republican Party that I think has moved well to the right on immigration compared to where it was when George W. Bush was president. When you say that there needs to be a legislative solution, what do you see as a path through that could actually get significant buy-in from Republicans and move through this Congress?
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's going to be much more likely that pieces of this get broken off and you see different coalitions coming together for it. It is a challenge with the makeup of the Senate right now in particular. There's no question about it. I mean, and the Senate's really where the ball game is, because the Democrats can do whatever they want in the House. I do think it's a challenge and probably is going to have to, it's going to take a few years. I mean, I don't think it's something that's going to happen overnight. The politics of immigration to me have become remarkably frustrating, because it seems to me, at least from my perspective, and again, I may not be illustrative of a lot of people, you know, in my part of the political coalition, but I think this is one area that we have to get right. And we have to get it right, not just because people's lives are at stake, but also because the future of our country's success depends on it. And I think fewer and fewer Republicans, unfortunately, take that point of view. I wish more would recognize that this is a really significant issue and that we do need to take action urgently on it, because if we don't, we're going to continue going into these back and forth cycles that end up becoming, I think, just as politically polarizing, if not more, than actually just having a debate over the immigration law. And the times when we've had the opportunity to do it, unfortunately, we haven't been able to get there for a variety of different reasons, some of which is related to Republicans standing in the way. Back a few years ago, I could argue, of course, presidential leadership from President Obama wasn't quite at the level it should have been to lead this effort. So maybe Joe Biden will have a different approach. But I don't have an easy answer for you, Josh, because the political environment right now is clearly not going to tolerate a big immigration reform bill. Maybe pieces of it can get through. Maybe there's a little bit more support for the Dreamers, even amongst some parts of the Republican coalition. But broad and more comprehensive reform probably is going to take some more time.
David, what do you think about that piecemeal approach? Because I know that's been controversial in the past. One question, I mean, for example, if you enact the DREAM Act, does that make it harder to do a broader legalization of people who are currently living in the U.S. without authorization, because you've sort of broken off the most sympathetic part of that population? And so that's been part of why there's been a push historically among Democrats to try to do immigration reform in a comprehensive way. Do you think a piecemeal approach is advisable? And do you think that there are key pieces of this that you could get through this Congress if you took a piecemeal approach?
I think that was the initial theory, and that animated the idea of comprehensive immigration reform. I think now there's more of a sense that you need to make as much progress as you can. And if that means a standalone solution for the Dreamers, then that's what it means. I obviously agree with Lanhi that this is going to be incredibly challenging. I will say that Republicans kind of shied away from immigration in the 2020 cycle, and that includes President Trump, who really didn't talk about immigration very much. There have been changes, if you look at public opinion polling, in terms of more sympathy for immigration, more approval of it. That doesn't necessarily raise to the political levels of the Republican Party, which is why I think it's going to be challenging. But it is interesting that whereas in 2016, Trump really ran on a very restrictionist approach to immigration, he did not do that in his reelection campaign, suggesting that there was enough blowback from the policies that he did put into place that it was difficult for him to continue on that path. And maybe that down the road pays a dividend in terms of a broader solution on immigration. I don't think the Republican Party is there right now. The question of whether you can get bits and pieces is one that should be explored, but I'm not sure that that's going to make much headway either. What I would say is, you know, with respect to immigration, you're going to have executive discretion any way you slice it. Even if you get a comprehensive bill, there's going to be bits, parts of this that are going to have to be managed by the Department of Homeland Security and Customs and Border Protection and so on. And the quickest way to make progress right now, I would think, is to end the sort of nickel and diming of immigrants that is being done right now. Under the Trump administration, if you filled out a certain form and didn't, you know, add a certain dash to something or didn't put in a line, and I know this from experience from people who I know have worked through the system, you would get denied. And it was just a constant struggle for people in the immigration system to manage a moving target, which was the way in which these forms had to be filled out and so on. And so just a relaxation of that and making that just the slightest bit, more welcoming, I think would go a longer way maybe than it would look like at first glance.
Priscilla, before we go, we're about to get what I would say is the first really prominent vote in this Congress on immigration, but it's not a legislative vote. It's a confirmation vote on Alejandro Mayorkas to be the Secretary of Homeland Security. This is the first cabinet nomination where you've had Republicans use a filibuster and force Democrats to overcome that filibuster, which only takes 50 votes for a nomination, but it adds some amount of time to what it takes to get the nomination through the Senate. So what do you make of the controversy over Mayorkas? Is that basically just a proxy fight over immigration policy? And how much Republican support is Mayorkas likely to get for his ultimate confirmation?
Well, I think we saw some divisions during the committee vote. So the first vote that he had to undergo, we had Romney, who said that he would vote for Mayorkas, Johnson, who was more skeptical. So we saw some factions within the Republican Party who had skepticism about the way he would approach immigration, the way he would approach the border wall and border security. But I think this is a good time as any to remind listeners that the Department of Homeland Security has not had a confirmed secretary since April of 2019. So that's nearly 2 years of functioning under acting leadership and many leaders at that. And so this is an incredibly important moment for the Department of Homeland Security to once again have permanent confirmed leadership that can lead the direction during a time that's not only focused on immigration, but also domestic threats and cybersecurity. So we will see that vote on Monday and anticipate that he'll be confirmed Monday evening and continue to see the rollout of announcements after that from the White House.
Priscilla Alvarez is an immigration reporter at CNN. Thank you very much, Priscilla.
Thank you.
I've been talking with David Dayan of the American Prospect and Lanhi Chen of the Hoover Institution. We will be back to talk for some reason about GameStop. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Lanhee Chen, fellow at the Hoover Institution. On the left is David Dayan, executive editor of The American Prospect. Something very stupid has been happening on Wall Street this week. The video game retailer GameStop, which was trading around $18 or $20 a share a month ago, has soared to $300 off enthusiasm from a Reddit message board. It's part of a broader trend of individual investors piling into stocks that certain hedge funds have been selling short. The funds have been betting that these stocks will go down because, for example, GameStop is unprofitable and physical retail of video games is a declining business. But when other investors start buying like crazy, it forces short sellers to start buying stock too because they have to cover their increasingly costly short positions. That buying pushes the stock up higher and drives other shorts to buy. This is called a short squeeze, which pushes the price up, and it's causing a lot of pain at certain hedge funds that probably got into recklessly large short positions in GameStop in the first place. But the end result of this is going to be that lots of retail investors, many of them unsophisticated, you can look at the App Store downloads and you can see how Robinhood, the trading app, is the number one download on the iPhone this week. They're buying GameStop at a price that implies it's worth as much as Best Buy, which is a much bigger company that actually makes money. So what's going to happen to them when the fad is over and GameStop falls back to a price that reflects its actual financial prospects? This is a finance story, but it also has significant political elements. The retail GameStop buyers have gotten rhetorical support from populist politicians on the right and on the left. Ted Cruz and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez both wanted to know why retail brokers were restricting purchases of GameStop just as the company's stock was going crazy. AOC tweeted, "We now need to know more about Robinhood App's decision to block retail investors from purchasing stock while hedge funds are freely able to trade the stock as they see fit." So, David, is equal access to stupid investments a left principle now? Because this is a talking point I've heard a lot from the right. We've had arguments over the last few years about whether it should be easier for regular people to invest in private companies. A lot of people on the left have warned that this is something that will open up investors to scams. Isn't that, you know, shouldn't we be a little more concerned about retail investors getting into this rather than being so focused on protecting their access?
Well, you said at the top there that something stupid happened on Wall Street this week, and I would broaden that out, that something stupid always happens on Wall Street. The original sin here was the hedge funds taking extremely large positions in shorting these and other stocks. And in fact, hedge funds like Citadel are profiting incredibly off the order flow from Robinhood, and they're apparently pretty good evidence that they are, you know, in milliseconds before they make those trades on behalf of retail investors, they're what is known as front-running the trades by using high-speed trading outlets to make the trade right before the Redditors make the trade. So stupid things happen all the time. I think what this episode shows is that there is a certain amount of market manipulation on Wall Street that is intolerable, and that the system that was set up and that lore suggests is still true, that these stocks reflect the expected future profits or some sort of productive activity that they're doing is rather artificial. And so I think that this should, you know, lead to a broader inspection of these markets and what is actually happening regarding manipulation within them. Fortunately, the Biden administration has Gary Gensler, who is a pretty aggressive regulator, about to be placed as the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission. And I think he should undergo a significant amount of investigation and regulation to look at the broader implications of what's happening here.
Lanhee, do you see policy lessons in this episode?
Well, I mean, this is the challenge, right? It's not clear to me, and I've you know, talked to some folks and done a little bit of thinking and research on this myself. It's just not clear to me what the right policy intervention is in this case. Look, by the way, the problem with GameStop is that you walk in and you can't find anything. I mean, that's the problem with GameStop. But beyond that, it's just that it's not clear to me that you know, what is the right policy lever to pull. So, for example, is the question, you know, do we need to make sure that investors have a better sense of financial literacy before they, you know, start trading, you know, in things that potentially could get them into a lot of trouble, you know, and financial literacy was very hot back in the Dodd-Frank era, when the Dodd-Frank Act was first, legislated and signed into law, fell off a little bit during the Trump administration. You know, should we be requiring enhanced consumer disclosures? You know, is that something we would look at? It's just not clear to me what the exact intervention is to address the issue at hand. And for that reason, it feels to me like this is a story that has captured people's minds in part because of some of the companies involved. Some of the companies are, kind of iconic in certain circles. There's a lot of intrigue around this back and forth, this David and Goliath between the retail investors and the big institutional investors. But at the end of the day, beyond sort of, Elizabeth Warren saying, well, we got to do something about this, and Ted Cruz saying, yeah, we got to do something about this, and AOC saying the same, at the end, I'm left a little bit unsatisfied because it's not clear to me what the exact intervention is and what it is. What's the problem we're trying to solve for in this situation? Are we trying to say that hedge funds can't take large short positions? I don't think that's a good policy conclusion at all. Are we saying that investors shouldn't be allowed to do the kind of high volume trading they're doing? Well, then that's going to put a whole bunch of people out of business who are retail investors. So it's just not clear to me what the right intervention is. And so at the end of the day, I don't think this is a policy problem so much as it's a financial market social kind of story. And, we'll have to see where it goes. But to me, at least, there doesn't seem to be an immediate policy answer here.
I think there are a number of policy answers, and maybe they come from my own idiosyncratic perspective, but I don't think hedge funds should exist. I think you should close the loopholes in the Investment Company and the Investment Advisors Act of 1940 that allowed them to flourish, and that would mandate disclosure, but also alter their fee structures and eliminate the use of leverage, which of course spins up these things into much larger positions than they could otherwise be. If you repealed Section 209 of the National Securities Markets Improvement Act of 1996, which allowed endowments and pension funds to get into hedge funds, making them increase tenfold in 7 years, you would go a long way to tamping down the, I feel, very unproductive activity in the public markets. You can crack down on market manipulation like pump and dump schemes, which the GameStop thing is a form of, quite frankly. The SEC could do that without new legislation. The Federal Reserve and the Financial Stability Oversight Council could restrict significant bank lending to hedge funds, which again uses leverage to increase these positions massively and create a lot of cascading problems potentially through the system. And you can ban certain speculative trading products that have no real productive value. I would say naked short selling, where you're selling and trading and making bets on stocks that you don't own, is one of them. Or the circumstance, which was true in GameStop's case, where the short selling position is more than 100% of the existing stock. I think there's a lot that you can do. And then the final thing would be, the sort of Pigovian tax that you would use normally if you want to discourage certain activity, which would be a financial transaction tax on short-term plays. So I think there are a number of policy things that this episode illuminates, things that I think should have been done a long time ago. But I think that the fact that the what we see right now in the markets has transpired, I think it's shown a bright spotlight on these issues. And I think that the Biden team should take action.
I want to stick up for the usefulness of price discovery and how that the markets are not ordinarily so stupid as they are this week, and the usefulness of short selling, which is to say that, I think it is a good first approximation that stock prices reflect the expected future earnings of companies, because that's why the stock market goes up over time, and it moves in line with after-tax corporate profits, which move somewhat in line with economic growth, although things change what share of the economy show up as after-tax corporate profits. If stock prices were basically random, you wouldn't have that long run upward trend. And the reason that we focused not just on this story, but you have conversations about, is Tesla's valuation reasonable? Does Uber's valuation make any sense? People talk about those because those companies are weird. Normally, you expect the valuation of a company to line up with its actual financial performance, which we should want for a number of reasons, because that makes it easier for companies that have better prospects to raise capital. Also, because executives are compensated based on how the stock does. So hopefully the move in the stock price ought to be associated with the underlying economic condition of the company. Otherwise, executives are being paid to do the wrong thing. But then short sellers play a small but significant role in this ecosystem, which is to say that when you have companies that are overvalued, they're the ones who actually put money on the line and try to expose why they're overvalued. And that can be valuable in the sense that, you know, that was something that helped expose Enron. That's something that helped expose Wirecard, the German payments company that was revealed to have a significant accounting scandal over the last several months. And we can look at what a market without shorts looks like, because the private market is a market without shorts. And you had Theranos, which went on for a decade with no product and burned through $1 billion and ended up with a non-functioning product rolling out in Walgreens stores, in part because nobody had a financial incentive to prove to the world that Theranos's product didn't work. We had to wait for an investigative journalist to figure that out. So I think that, you know, that you can always identify significant problems with the public markets. And I'm sure that there are regulatory improvements that could reduce those. But I think people sort of are a little bit too negative on this process that actually does a fair amount to improve the efficiency of the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a bit of an overlooking on your part of the ordinary business of touting, busting up, breaking down various companies by activists, hedge funds, which we've seen over a large period. I think we're ignoring sort of the rise of algorithmic trading that is disconnected in many ways to even people's ordinary wants or desires in terms of the stock markets. We saw that with the flash crash several years ago, which was caused by someone hitting a button wrong. I mean, I think there are bigger problems than you indicate that maybe aren't seen in the aggregates, but are seen in many, many specific examples. And I don't have a problem with short selling per se. I agree with you in terms of its potential function. I have a problem with the types of short selling that goes on where there's not even an underlying ownership of the stock. And at that point, it's just bets. I mean, I think we can separate what is productive within the public markets with what is completely unproductive. And I think this is a moment that we can attack those unproductive elements and rid them from the system. It would only make the system more efficient and better.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. David Dayan, what's your rant?
Well, California ended its stay-at-home order this week, and in pandemic-ravaged Los Angeles, where I am, restaurants opened for outdoor dining on Friday, the same day as a driving rainstorm, and I think that should maybe be taken as an omen. The steady decrease in cases and hospitalizations that seems to be triggering this in California and nationwide is likely to be a false dawn, I'm sorry to say. More contagious variants, which have already appeared here, will rapidly become the dominant strain, just as a mathematical matter, within weeks or maybe a couple months. We're in sort of a terrible race between that reality and the consequent final and potentially very deadly outbreak and vaccinating enough people to blunt the worst effects. We only have about a month or two, and we can win this race by accelerating vaccination and taking maximum precautions in the final stretch. But opening up patios to capacity for pizza and beer seems to send a tragically wrong signal in this moment.
Lan Hee Chen, what's on your mind?
Well, act first and avoid questions later. That's the mantra that California Governor Gavin Newsom has followed through the darkest days of the COVID-19 pandemic. His latest decision to suddenly lift shelter-in-place orders across much of the state came as a surprise even to lawmakers of his own party, who complained about Newsom's lack of communication and go-it-alone style. The bigger problem for Californians is that the governor's erratic decision-making, where edicts come down from Sacramento without a clear rationale or presentation of the data underlying them. One day, we're completely shut down, and then the next, we're not. Californians know the final decisions that Newsom reaches, but there's no transparency to help them understand the how and why. This isn't how government at any level in this country should be making policy. It's time for Newsom and other leaders across America to understand that leaving citizens in the dark only worsens the distrust that already exists between the governing and the governed.
For my rent, the school board of San Francisco has voted to rename 44 schools that are currently named after such boogie persons as Abraham Lincoln, Paul Revere, and Dianne Feinstein. They came up with a list of reasons why people might be offended by these various names. Now, they have voted on this renaming. They spent a 7-hour meeting discussing this before they voted on this renaming at a time when these school buildings are closed. They're closed to students because of the pandemic. And as Mayor London Breed has pointed out, why are you spending time on this when you should be spending time trying to figure out how to get kids back in the classroom? People overuse the term political correctness, but this is absolutely a case of political correctness and one that is especially ill-timed. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Lonnie Chen, David Dayan, and Priscilla Alvarez. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thank you for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.